Welcome to this edition of What's Up Bainbridge, brought to you by BARN, Bainbridge Artisan Resource Network. I'm your host, Bob Ross. Today we start a two-part series and welcome the author of a new book to our studio with an intriguing and rather unusual name of the book. It's called The Brain-Based Classroom, Accessing Every Child's Potential Through Educational Neuroscience. Kiran Omani, welcome to our program. There's a lot to think about in that title. Give us an overview and we'll dig in a little deeper.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, it is a very strange title. I would not have chosen this title myself. But the publisher, it's a Routledge book, and Routledge is the number one academic publisher in the world. So I listen to them when they say things to me. They said, this is where the market is. And I thought, oh, I don't like this market. It's going to turn people off, especially parents with young children. But it is about the classroom. The problem is the classroom has shifted in the last couple of years because of COVID. So today the classroom is actually in your home. In the old days, it was in loco parentis. Well, guess what? The parent is in the classroom today. And we're in the classroom and we're in the home of the parent. So the book is not necessarily the best title for what it does, because it does talk to parents and teachers about what's going on with their children, helping them to understand why one child is easy to teach and why another child has difficulty accessing the same information.
One thing that I really pick up when I look through your book and read various sections is that the parent and the child are really on equal footing in terms of how a person might want to think about your child's education. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is the parent has as much responsibility here as, you know, sending the kid off to school to be taught by the teacher.
You are so right, Bob. You know, the way I look at it, it's a three-legged stool. You have to have the teacher and the student and the parent involved, because if you don't, you're going to have, one of the legs is falling off, well, it's going to fall apart. You have to have the same vocabulary, you have to have the same understandings, and you particularly have to have a communication between the parent, teacher, and the student that makes sense.
One thing we should talk about before we dig into the book a little deeper is, who are you? Where do you come from? You have a bit of an accent.
You're right, yeah. And we just talked about Donegal. I come from Ireland, and I actually came here in 1982 for one weekend. I came for one weekend to Seattle. I didn't know Seattle existed at the time, and I find myself still here. Not because I had chosen to stay here, but because I felt it was my duty to stay, because I knew that the answer was here. The answer I was looking for was, why would a 13-year-old boy from my classroom in a small school in Ireland commit suicide on his 13th birthday? It was way beyond my understanding. I knew I hadn't enough training. I thought that some place that had the amazing philosophy for living called life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness would know the answers. I was sure if I came here, I'd get the answer and I could bring it straight back to Ireland. Well, guess what? When I came here, I realized that not only was the answer not available readily like that, but it was so complex here with the diversity and with the melting pot of cultures and races. It was such a more difficult situation to solve. But I also felt that I had to solve it. I needed to solve it. And I was lucky. I got to meet some people here who helped me solve it.
You refer to yourself as a learning scientist, not a teacher.
Yeah. I started out a teacher, and I always assumed that that teacher was good enough. I thought that, education and teaching was who I was. That was my identity. But when I got to the University of Washington, the College of Education, and I in particular got to work with some amazing people like Dr. Bransford. John Bransford had come in from Vanderbilt, and he was now in charge of what they call the Life Center, Learning in Informal and Formal Environments. That was a $50 million 10-year project to study how children learn. And I glommed onto that very quickly because I wanted to know the answers. And he said something one day that got my attention. He said, we distinguish between educators and learning scientists because we want to stay out of the behaviorist model. And I thought, what is he talking about? It makes no sense. What is a behaviorist model? And I began to do research with him. And for the next 10 years, we investigated a lot of questions about education. And I began to get some deep understanding about what the difference was between a learning scientist and a teacher. And the learning scientist is a person who looks at the pedagogy. And the pedagogy means that hidden layers between the actual knowledge and the learner themselves. There's a lot of stuff happens in between that allows the child to access the information because we know what we're doing as we present it.
As I was reading your book, that word pedagogy, I had to look up. I didn't know what it meant. And so you're starting to explain it, but is it like a model on how we approach?
The way I look at it is this: there's a pedagogical content layer in between the teacher and the student. And it means that, yeah, as a teacher, I've got a whole body of knowledge about something I'm teaching. It might be math or science or geography or something. Mm. And then there's a learner who has a big space in his head that says, I want to learn about this math or science or geography. Well, if I just try and stick it into your head, it's not going to work. However, if I get you to be curious and if I get your intrigued about why something is broken, I basically have to have some disequilibrium in your brain to say, hey, the stuff I thought was right is not right anymore. I had preconceived ideas and they were now misconceived ideas, and you're going to give me new information that'll correct those misconceptions and preconceptions. And the point is that, take for instance a child that learns very early that the sun comes out by day and the moon comes out by night, and everything is cool and life is good. And they have a mental model and they know this information. And then on a particular Tuesday, you're walking outside in Bainbridge and you say, oh my goodness, look at that. The moon is out there and the sun is over there. And the kid says, how could that be? Now, what you've done is you've introduced disequilibrium to cause that preconception, which was a misconception, to be now disrupted. And the child will have to take that prior knowledge, and with new information that we're going to do and co-create together, they will make a new conception of the world, and there's room in your brain for both. You can still remember that you thought the sun and the moon were in two separate spaces, but now you know something else, and you can see your thinking shift. That's a metacognitive moment. And so all these terms I'm throwing at you, preconceptions, misconceptions, metacognition, that's the pedagogic content knowledge.
Okay, I got you. I mean, at least in part, I got you. There's a lot more to learn here. And I you know, going back to the book, just for a moment, the title of it, where does a person go to see it, to get it, if they want? After listening to this discussion, they're interested in digging in deeper. How can they access your book?
Oh, yeah. So if you're a teacher, you immediately, of course, you go to your principal and say, I want this book. And they say, where can we get it? And they say, oh, it's on Amazon. Well, yeah, of course it's on Amazon. All books are. But the publisher is Routledge. They come out of London and out of New York. But there are two versions. One is the academic version for libraries, which is about $150. But the one you want is probably is less than that. It's about $26, and it's available in Amazon.
And they can go online,
yeah,
and do a research or
yeah,
a search on
yeah
it. And Routledge is Routledge.
Yeah, Routledge. And so Routledge, they stalked me for about 5 years. I was doing a conference call. I was actually face-to-face pre-COVID at the Seattle Convention Center. And they had, in the audience, there was a Routledge rep. And at the end, he said to me, this is so important. You got to get this into a book. And I said, go away, I can't do that. That's way beyond my pay scale. Plus, I don't have time. I mean, there's so much to do and teachers need this work. I need to work with my teachers. And so every 6 months they call me and they said, did you write the book yet? And I said, go away, it's not going to happen. And then suddenly COVID happened and I'm sitting at home alone and I'm thinking, I've got most of this book already written. Maybe I should just put it together. And I wrote it down and I stayed there from January till March and I got the thing written up. And then Rutledge said to me, we want 60,000 words. And I said, 60,000 words? I just wrote 600,000 words. They said, we only want 60,000. So that was the crisis. Getting from March to July, I had to get rid of, you know, a lot of words.
One of the nice things about the book is the way it's put together in terms of organization, because you're right, and it's really packed full of a lot of stuff. You write, and then at the end of each chapter, you have vocabulary, the key ideas or words that you brought up in what you just read. And then there's a nice summary as well. So you can always go back to that after you've read it and kind of refresh your your mind.
Yeah. So when I'm teaching teachers, I put the teacher into the pedagogic model. They have to experience it themselves first, because then they're going to be able to bring it to the classroom and use it for the teachers. Well, the pedagogic model is how the book is designed. Each chapter is in the model. That means that it's a brain-based, a brain-aligned methodology for people to be able to access knowledge. In other words, there's a lot of information, but your brain can't take it all in, because guess what? We have a thing called the limitation of working memory space. And if I gave you my phone number today, you'd probably say, you give it to me again, 206-499-0176. Wait, that's too much. But you know, 206, that's Seattle, that's easy. And then 499, okay, 4 and 2 9s. And you have a little way of chunking it down so you can try and remember it. But if I gave you my phone number in Ireland and I said to you 011-353-86-478-2173, you're like, okay, that's it. I can't do this. Because you haven't got a schema for understanding information going from here to Ireland. Unless you had a girlfriend that you called every day in Ireland, then you'd probably figure it out. But, you know, the thing is, I call my brother over there. So for me, I have a schema. It's easy. 011 gets out of America. 353 gets into Ireland. 86 gets into the Mux in Belfast. Then 573 is Dublin. And I go down the street to my house, 4782. And that's the way it works. You have a mental schema, and that helps us to acquire knowledge. So our pedagogic model is in the book, every chapter. Our teachers learn how to do that, and then children can access information more readily.
That kind of comes around to this next question, and that is the 21st century child being out of sync with schools and how kids are taught, basically.
Yeah, this is very, very important. And I didn't know this because I'm not a 21st century child. I grew up in 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s. That's my identity. But when I come here and I'm with my children, I realize that they have a fluency and a capacity for all kinds of technology that I never had. I have to think carefully about how to get my camera to work on my phone. They can just do it and they're already fingering it. And they know what to do at age 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. The children that we grew up in our time, we were in a two-dimensional world. And a two-dimensional world was good, bad, right, wrong, sit down, listen to me, shut up, and do as I tell you. Well, today's child is a different child. They're in a four-dimensional world at least, maybe fifth dimension, and I'll talk about that too. But the four dimensions are very simple. If you think about when you floss your teeth in the morning, that's a string segment, that's one dimension. Then your page here in front of you, 8.5 by 11, that's a two-dimensional, length by breadth. Then I take a cube, that's three-dimensional. Now, how do you get to a four-dimensional? And I asked this to a 10-year-old, these bunch of kids sitting around alongside me, 10-year-olds. I said, okay, how do you conceptualize four dimensions? And I thought this would be a bit of a discussion. I thought for a start, we'd have at least a good talk about it. And a kid says to me, oh, that's easy. That's a donut. And I'm going, what? And I didn't say that because I didn't want to look stupid and shocked in front of this 10-year-old. And so when they were gone, I went on Google and I typed in mathematical representation of four dimensions. And I got a brand new word that I'd never seen before. Now, I've been around a long time and I've done a lot of studies. The word torus. Now, I'm sure, T-O-R-U-S, I'm sure your listeners who are mathematicians will say, of course, yeah, torus. But most of us never hear of torus in our whole lives. And when you take something like a torus and you look for the mathematical formulas behind it, you get all the sines and cosines and tangents, right? Which most of us who are not mathematical get lost and we say, okay, we've had enough of that. But then you press a button for visualization on the computer and it's a cube that moves over time because time is a fourth dimension and it becomes a donut. And you think, these children are thinking in four dimensions already. This cell phone that they're holding in their hands is an extension to their working memory space. They don't remember in phone numbers. They don't need to. It's already in Google. You know, they've got it. And so these children are stuck in a two-dimensional school system, but they're thinking in four dimensions. Yeah. So we take our teachers and this brain-based alignment we do in this book takes the teachers into that fourth dimension and they allow the students to accelerate and thrive because they know what we're doing.
As you're explaining this, I'm thinking about my interaction with my grade school grandchildren. And it's the same thing. I mean, the way they go about things, the way they think about things is way out there compared to my approach to things. Because I grew up in the same period you did.
Yeah.
And right, wrong, This is the way you do it. This is the way you don't do it.
Yeah.
And this is so that leads me to a question that comes to mind, and that is a young parent with grade school kids. How do you encourage them to interact? Or maybe some of the parents are already there by now.
Some are, and some are still. I mean, in fairness, we don't have. When the infant is born, there is no guidebook that says this is how to raise this child. And so we look at the child and say, okay, good, they've got five fingers and toes and they've got nice eyes and ears. But we have no idea what's going on inside in the brain. Yeah. And here's the ideal thing is we as adults have very few mental models about what's really happening in the brain. And most of what we know is wrong. That's the crazy thing. And I'm talking about myself. And I was shocked to find out that I spend my whole life in a classroom teaching children, and the stuff I thought about the brain was completely wrong. And I'll tell you why in a second. But first of all, think about that infant child. The child is born, has 100 billion neurons, the same as you and me, but they're not connected yet. Some of them are, but most aren't. I'm sure your parents out there will know this. When the child is born, they say, man, this child knows a lot. This child is like it looks like my grandfather already. It's a wise old child already. But they don't know how or why. But the child has a lot of innate capacity as it's born. And then the second thing is language. They have a language capacity that happens because they can pick up grammar and vocabulary so fast and make it happen in the mother tongue. Whatever that is, it could be Chinese or French or English or Bainbridge Island, you know, and that's who they are. They have their identity about their language. And so, yeah, as parents, we have a lot of questions about why is my little girl over here doing so well and my little boy over here, he's just struggling. What's the crisis here? And we know now because we can see since the decade of the brain, which was 1990 to 2000, we have so much more information today about brain that we didn't have when I was growing up. And particularly, we look at the ANS reactivity of children. Now, that means the autonomic nervous system reactivity. That's something that you don't have to send them off to an fMRI lab to do or something like that. We know them. You have a sensitive child and you have a resilient child. And the sensitive child is the child that's going to cost you a lot in terms of money and time. It's always whining and needs help and needs picking up and needs attention. The other child is just breezing through life and there's no problem. And so you know already if you've got high ANS, which is a very expensive child, or low ANS, which is a very easy child. If you've raised three or four children, you know you've got one or two that are like, oh my God, think about this. Mommy, I want to play soccer. Okay, well, we'll join the team. And now we buy the boots and the gear and the clothes and we spend $3,000 and we're out in the field and the coach says, hey, I told you not to kick the ball like that. And the child says, Mommy, I'm never playing soccer again. And you think, but we spent all that money. That's an expensive child. Very sensitive. And the coach said the wrong thing at the wrong time and that's soccer done for the rest of his life or her life. And then she says, I'd like to play tennis. You say, oh God, that's very expensive. And then you buy a racket and you buy gear and they're out there and she hits the ball and it doesn't go over the net. She goes, I don't want to play tennis anymore. And you think, oh my God, this child's going to kill me. And that's who we have. We have very sensitive children, high ANS reactivity, or we have very resilient children, low ANS reactivity. And the bad news is there are some people in between. And I'm an in-betweener. So I can be very sensitive or I can be very resilient. But at least now that I know, and I didn't find out until I was 55, now I can do something with it. This information that I'm giving you is only 3 years old. The data came from research up at UBC, just across the border here, with Dr. Boyce. And his book, the beautiful book, is The Orchid and the Dandelion. And so the children who are sensitive, you have to raise like orchids. And the children who are dandelionic, you can raise them like weeds. It doesn't matter. They'll survive. And so that's the way we look at children today. We look at them at their autonomic nervous system reactivity.
Well, Kieran, we've been talking here for a while, and I think there's a lot more to cover. And so let's put it into a second podcast. Does that sound good to you?
That sounds fantastic. And by the way, when we talk about education, we think about uncovering. We never talk about covering. That was an older model in my day, in your day. We had things, we covered them. That doesn't mean we actually understood them. So when we uncover things with children, the children have to get involved in a co-created space so that they begin to uncover the information and make sense of it for them. It's orthogonal to the way we usually think. So that's part of the whole brain-based thing is, of course, if you knew what was happening inside in the child's brain, you would only do it this way and never that way.
again, give us the name of the book and how people can access it.
Yeah, the book is called The Brain-Based Classroom, and it's available from Amazon. It probably is in your local bookstore, but who knows? Amazon, definitely.
Kieran, thank you very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on this edition of What's Up, Bainbridge, brought to you by BARN, Bainbridge Artisan Resource Network.